questions about anything from last week?
Time? So today I'm going to introduce a space of functions called the Schwartz space S. It's a space of rapidly decreasing functions at infinity. So remember, we've been dealing with a space called the moderately decreasing functions at infinity. So let's see, this is going to be the set of F that are continuous on the whole real line, and they satisfy an estimate like this. F of x is less than or equal to some number over 1 plus x squared. So they go to 0 fast enough at infinity that they're absolutely integrable. And you can compare them with the arctangent function, which is that integral of that thing. So let's see, we're going to be applying Fourier transform to that kind of function. Let me make a remark here that these make it safe to sort of truncate integrals. So safe to ignore integral of x bigger than something big for functions in M. You can always pick an epsilon, then I can find it x big enough so that that integral outside is negligible when you're doing calculations. So that's an important property. So, for example, if I had a function that was clearly not integrable, like, say, integral from minus infinity, let's take something that's ridiculously not integrable, like x. It's positive to the right and negative to the left. And you might ask, is this the limit as n goes to infinity of the integral from minus n to n? Well, the plus area cancels the negative area in this, and so this is always zero. And so this limit exists and is zero. But this doesn't make any sense at all. This is in the positive infinity minus the negative infinity area, and it doesn't make any sense. But of course, it's not in the class M because it doesn't even go to zero at infinity. So this is the kind of danger we're trying to avoid by making these functions go to zero fast enough at infinity. This thing actually is called the principal value of the integral. And sometimes the principal value of an integral would exist even though the thing is not absolutely integrable. So this thing on this side is called the principal value. Of the integral from minus infinity to infinity of x dx. So sometimes that makes sense and the limit exists. But the fact is, for m, we don't have to worry about these things. The integral from minus infinity to infinity of f dx equals, we can split it into pieces, minus infinity to 0, plus 0 to infinity. Or we can take limits. Let's see. We can let 1a go to minus infinity. And we can let this b go to plus infinity. Or we can do the principal value thing. We don't have to sweat about any of these things. We're safe. And if you're going to compare any of these, you would have this tail end of the integral to compare, and you can make that less than epsilon and just chuck it.
So here's some basic properties
of integrals that we're gonna deal with. Properties of the integral from minus infinity to infinity on this space of functions of moderate decrease at infinity. An obvious one is that this operator is linear. I can pull constants out in front of the integral, and the integral of a sum is the sum of the integrals. So that's nothing to check. Slightly more interesting one is that if I translate a function, I don't change the integral. And this is particularly clear if you think of this integral as an area. It'd be the area above the graph minus the area below the graph. If I pick that graph up and move it a few feet left or right, it doesn't change that sum. So that's the right way to think about it. So this integral, if I shift the function, would be the same as the integral of the function itself. Just picking up an area and moving it to the left or right. If I dilate a function, so the integral of f of k times x dx, we're going to do the change of variables and find out that that's 1 over k times the integral of the undilated function. And the last one, this is kind of like a difference quotient without the bottom part. The integral from minus infinity to infinity, if I translate the function by a shift and subtract the original function and integrate. The idea is on a compact interval, if I make h small, this would be small on the compact interval. And outside the big thing, this is small period. So this is going to go to 0. As h goes to 0. These are going to be useful when we study the Fourier transform. It'll allow us just to spit a bunch of facts out real quick. Let's see, I'll give some quick proofs of these. I won't do them all because they're all kind of similar. So here's a proof. Let's prove 2. That was the one about translations not changing the integral. So if I have a finite integral, the integral from a to b of x plus h dx, I do a change of variables and call this, how about a tau, or how about a u? Then of course du is equal to dx. I'm thinking of h as a constant, which it is in this integral. And when x is equal to the left end point, u would be equal to a plus h. And when x is equal to the right end point, u would be equal to b plus h. So if I call this my integral, then my integral is, when I change variables, integral from a plus h to b plus h of f of u du. And now I let a go to minus infinity and b go to plus infinity. Clear, if h is just a little small thing, or just it's a fixed thing, it doesn't have to be small, but these are still going to go to infinity, plus and minus infinity, if I let that h go along for the ride there. So this goes to the integral from minus infinity to infinity of f dx, as I let a go to minus infinity and b go to plus infinity. So that's all there is to that one. The others are very similar, so I'm not going to waste time doing them, but let's think about 4. That one's a little bit interesting. That's the one about sort of the difference quotient thing. So let's let epsilon be bigger than zero. And we've got an F in our class M. That means the integrals on the outside are getting really small, outside of a big interval. So there would exist an R such that, oh, let's take a little buffer zone here. Let's take the integral of absolute F over the modulus, the absolute value of X. I'd like to say bigger than R, but I'll make it even bigger than R minus 1. Just so I'll have a buffer zone, dx. Oh, let's make that less than epsilon over 4. And let's assume our h is, we're going to let h go to 0, so we might as well assume that absolute h is less than 1. Well, f is continuous, and so it's uniformly continuous on, I'll give myself that, I'm going to make my buffer zone overlap my other buffer zone. So that's going to be minus r minus 1 to plus r plus 1. That's a compact closed and bounded interval, and so a continuous function on a closed and bounded interval is uniformly continuous. So, there exists a delta such that f of x plus h minus f of x is less than, I don't know, how small do I want it? How about epsilon over 4r. That might be overkill. If mod h, absolute h is less than delta, and why don't I make my delta less than 1? And now it's just a matter of writing out that integral and pulling it into pieces. I think I'll only do one of these carefully because they're all kind of very similar feeling. So when I pull this apart, let's see. First I'll pull it into, this would be less than the integral of mod x is bigger than r of f of x plus h dx plus integral of mod x bigger than r of mod f of x dx. And then I'd have the stuff in the middle, plus the integral from minus r to r of f of x plus h minus f of x dx. When I translate that back, I get that less than, did I make that less than epsilon over 4 or epsilon over 2? Oh, good. So these two are going to be less than epsilon over 4. And this is the one where I had the uniform continuity. This one's going to be, let's see, the biggest this thing would get would be epsilon over 4r times the length. And the length is 2r. And so I get epsilon over 2 there. So check. By making h small enough, I get that all to add up something less than small. So this is a, I'm going to let you read in Stein. You get your estimate carefully on a compact set, and then the tail ends you can throw away by this trick and ignore. And so that's always the strategy. Well, those facts hold for moderately decreasing functions. I promised you today I was going to introduce a new class. And the motivation for this new class is, remember my bump function, the Bell, the Gaussian. I like to call it phi. It's phi of x equals e to the minus pi x squared. And last time I showed you that the integral from minus infinity to infinity of phi of x dx is equal to 1. So it's a bump function. We're going to use it as approximation to the identity. And today I want to get to showing you that it's its own Fourier transform. I will show that the Fourier transform of this phi is itself. Of course, this is a function of s, and this is a function of x. I'm going to show you they're the same function. Well, this function, the Gaussian, is an example of a rapidly decreasing function at infinity. So phi is in this space S, which is called the Schwarz space. This is Laurent Schwarz, not the German Schwarz. There's a Schwarz and a Schwarz. This is Laurent Schwarz with a TZ. Of functions. So we had moderately decreasing functions. These are decreasing like crazy. Rapidly decreasing. Functions at infinity. Okay, what are the Schwarz functions? You can multiply a Schwarz function by any power of x, and it will still go to zero at infinity. So here's what s is. F in s means take any derivative of f. So I'll take an nth derivative of f and multiply by any power of x and take the limit as x goes to plus or minus infinity. So they go to zero so fast at infinity that even if I multiply by a big power of x, even if I take a big derivative, they still go to zero at infinity. For each n and n in z plus. Or let's say, I guess I can take the zeroth order derivative too. So let's say a natural number, including zero. Okay, that's the definition. Another way to say it, equivalently.
With that, x goes to infinity, x goes to minus infinity, is that just like either limit?
Right. Okay. Another way to say the same thing is that the supremum over all the real numbers of nth derivative of f of x times x to the nth power is finite for every pair of n and n. Okay.
Also, some simple facts to see about this class is that when you take a Schwartz function, you can multiply it by powers of x, or you can take derivatives, and it stays in the Schwartz class. So let's see, f in S implies f prime is in S. That's easy, just by the definition. And f in S implies x times f. Oops, x times f is in S. So you can do these two operations over and over again.
Derivative is differentiate and keep multiplying by higher and higher powers of x. What you can see is that
f and s implies polynomials times derivatives of f. So you can take differential operators that have polynomials as coefficients, etc., and stay in S. It's like the best space to do PDE. So polynomials times derivatives. Of f in stay in S.
Okay, now let me show you why these are kind of relevant to the Fourier transform. Remember when we take the transform of a derivative, it spits out S times the function. And it turns out if you'd have x times the function and take the Fourier transform, it takes the derivative in the transform space. And that's exactly what happens in Schwartz here. And if you do that kind of stuff over and over again, the great news is you stay in the Schwartz class. So here's a big fact.
If f is in S, then f hat is in S. The Fourier transform stays in S. And I think I'll let you read the proof of that in Stein. It's just a matter of realizing that you can differentiate and multiply over and over again and you don't wreck things. So, but here's important properties of the Fourier transform that are going to make the inversion formula just pop right out of the Fourier transform on S. Let's write f of x. Here's what I want to write, but I'm not going to do it. I want to write this, a squiggly arrow. But that's too much work. I'm going to just write an arrow. And the Fourier transform, remember, is an integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of x e to the 2 minus 2 pi I x s dx.
So x is a dummy variable that integrates out and leaves me a new function of s. And there's the s right there. Okay, so I've got a function of x here, and it sends me to a new function of s. That's the Fourier transform. And I'm going to assume that f is in S. Then this thing's going to be in S too.
And here's the properties I want to enumerate. One, if I take the Fourier, if I translate a function,
so instead of taking f of x, I take f of x plus h.
That's going to spit out a new transform, and it's related to the regular transform. This is kind of like a Laplace transform table. S, it pulls out an e to the I, 2 pi I sh, times the original transform of f. That's a straightforward calculation that I'll do in a second. And there's always, whenever you have one of these rules, there's a dual rule
Or if you put this on this side, then it kind of spits out the analogous thing.
So the analogous thing is if you multiply a function by e to the minus 2 pi I x times h, that would Fourier transform to a shifted function.
This is because the Fourier transform is basically its own inverse, except for this plus or minus annoyance. That's why, even though this is a plus 2 pi I, this one's going to be a minus 2 pi I. Because the inverse transform has a different sign in that spot.
Okay. Let's see. If I take a new function f of delta times x, then this would spit out 1 over delta f hat of s over delta.
That's kind of like what I do when I make approximations to the identity. That's going to be important. This keeps the integral being the same, and it compresses, if delta is small, it compresses the area, the mass, into a little bump function about zero. So that's going to be an important fact to use later on.
And here's a biggie. Differentiation gets transformed to multiplication by S. 2 pi I S times the Fourier transform.
That's what the exciting thing I was telling you about. The Fourier transform turns differentiation into multiplication by S, and so it turns differential equations into algebra equations. That's exciting.
One more. Let's see, minus the dual one to this, if I multiply by x in the x side, then that corresponds to differentiating on the Fourier transform side.
So those come in pairs, kind of. But this one is its own pair.
Let's see, what would be a fun thing to do right now? I don't feel like. I think I'll save the proofs because they get kind of repetitive and not a whole lot of fun. But I want to show you how I can use these things to show you that that bump function, the Gaussian, is its own Fourier transform. So my plan right now is I will use these to show that the Gaussian is its own Fourier transform. That's kind of fun. Okay, so let's write, I'll call it capital F of S, is going to be the Fourier transform of the Gaussian. So that would be the integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus pi x squared e to the minus 2 pi I x s dx.
Did I say that the Gaussian is an S? That's an easy, I think I did. But it's an easy thing to check. If you start differentiating this, it just brings out polynomials in x. If you multiply it by polynomials, there's more polynomials in x. But remember, this thing dies away so fast at infinity that it dominates and kills any polynomial in front. So it's really easy to see that that's in the S. Just because you know exponentials die away faster than any polynomial.
Okay. Notice if I differentiate this, you can basically just do whatever you want with the Schwarz function. The tail end of the derivative goes away so fast, the integral dies away so fast,
then I can just do whatever I want and differentiate under the integral sign.
I'll write out a careful argument like that once or twice, but once you do it once, you realize it's the same every time. Let's see, if I differentiate underneath the integral sign here, it would be like differentiating that S and using the chain rule. It's going to spit out Let's see, this would just sit there. And then when I differentiate under the integral sign, this would spit me out a minus 2 pi I x e to the minus 2 pi I x s dx.
So they are differentiated under the integral sign. And now look at this. Minus 2 pi x, that's, if I were to use the chain rule and differentiate this, that's what would pop out in front of that.
So here's the thing to observe. I'll pull that I outside the whole mess. And then I'll rearrange this to look like 2 pi x, minus 2 pi x, e to the minus pi x squared. That's the derivative of something. And so the aha here is that this is phi prime. Phi was equal to e to the minus x squared. So this is my phi. And the derivative of that phi is that phi prime right there. But this is the Fourier transform of phi prime. Sure, I'm getting close. This is I times the Fourier transform of phi prime. And remember that the Fourier transform of phi prime would be I times 2 pi I s times the Fourier transform. And that's what I was calling my capital F of s. And so now if you look, go back and look at what I've got my F prime of s.
I've got an I times an I, so that's a minus 2 pi
F, s times f of s. That's just an ODE, and it's a rather easy ODE. Let's see, how would I solve that in Math 262? This is f prime over f equals minus 2 pi s. This is d by ds of the log of f. This side is d by ds of minus pi s squared. And so what I see is that d by ds of the natural log of f plus pi s squared is identically zero. That means it's constant. So this thing is a constant k. Okay, so let's see, that gives me that natural log of mod of f is equal to k minus pi s squared. And so now if I exponentiate both sides, that would give me that f of s is e to the k times e to the minus pi s squared.
Getting close. I want to show that this bump function, this is going to be the bump function. I've got this annoying constant e to the k there.
And I can figure out what k to e to the k is by looking at f of 0. So the last step here is e to the k is going to be e to the k. It's the function at 0. And that function at 0, remember, is the Fourier transform at 0. And that's the integral from minus infinity to infinity, e to the minus pi x squared, e to the minus 2 pi I x times big fat 0 dx.
In other words, it's the integral of the bump. And that was the thing I showed you using Fubini's theorem last time,
is 1. So let's see, this is 1. And the integral of that bump, famous bump, is equal to 1. And so we're done. Check. So that means that f of s is e to the minus pi s squared. And that means that Fourier transform is the same function I started out with. I feel like I did enough technical things for one day. Here's how I like to think about Fourier transform. Oops. Stein has a clever, neater way to do it, so it's not going to have to think so hard. But here's a way to think about the Fourier transform. On Schwarz functions. Okay, so I'm going to make an approximation to the identity out of this bump function. It's going to be 1 over epsilon phi of x over epsilon.
That's going to concentrate the bump in a concentrated manner at the origin.
And we're going to show that f is equal to the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of these Schwarz functions, of these bump functions convolved with f. And if you write that out as an integral, let's see, that would be an integral from minus infinity to infinity of phi epsilon of x minus t, f of t dt. All right, write that out as a Riemann sum. If you write it out as a Riemann sum, okay, if I write it out as a Riemann sum, it's going to be looking like a sum of phi epsilon of x minus ti times numbers. So this is going to be a ci times x minus ti.
So this thing is going to be close to f. This means I can approximate any function in my Schwarz class by a bunch of these little bump things shifted. And these bump things shifted satisfy the Fourier inversion formula. So that's how I like to think about the Fourier inversion formula. I understand it on the bump functions, and therefore I understand it on all functions, because all functions can be approximated by finite sums of bump functions.
And you can make a proof out of that. So this is a finite sum. The fact that they die away so fast at infinity means I can chuck the stuff that's far away. So I'm going to take a finite Riemann sum. Okay, and so the philosophy is I know the Fourier inversion formula. For these bumps, these translated things,
I can approximate any function very closely by such things, and that's, I could take a limit and get the Fourier inversion formula for general f.
Take limits in S to get the general f, the Fourier inversion formula for f.
Okay, I guess to finish off today, I'm going to demonstrate two of those formulas that are kind of straightforward. Let's see, what was my proof of number? Proof of f of x plus h goes to e to the 2 pi I SH F hat of S. That's going to be an easy one. Let's see. So this, the Fourier transform of F of X plus H is this.
And remember one of those integral facts? If you shift an integral, it doesn't change the integral. Well, I'm going to shift this integral by putting an x minus h in that.
So replace x
and I'm going to do it in the whole integral.
So remember, the shifting doesn't change the value of the integral. That's going to be equal to integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of x my x here, I have to put my x minus h right here. S dx.
And sure enough, that's going to pop out what I want to pop out.
So when I pull it out, I'd get, notice it's a minus, so when I pull that constant thing out there, that would be e to the plus 2 pi I hs times the integral of what's left. And that's the Fourier transform of f. So check. There's one of those. And now I want to do one more and call it a day. Another good one on the list is that this one's a good one. Proof that f prime hat equals 2 pi I s f hat. Those are my two favorite ones on the list. And I'll let you read the rest in Stein. Jeez. Let's see. So that's just a matter of writing down the integral from minus infinity to infinity of f prime of x e to the minus 2 pi I xs dx.
Okay.
That's the limit. Doesn't matter how I take my limits here. I can take the limit as n goes to infinity of a symmetric interval minus n to n. I'm going to change the order right here. I'll have e to the minus 2 pi I xs. And here I have f prime of x dx. That's going to be my dv. integration by parts, and this is going to be a u in my integration by parts. And so let's see, if so u is this, e to the minus 2 pi I xs, so du is going to be, when I differentiate, I would get a minus 2 pi I s that pops out, times e to the minus 2 pi I xs dx. And of course, if dv is f prime of x dx, then v is f of x. And so integration by parts, that integral, to continue, that would be the limit as n goes to infinity. I'll have a u times v minus the integral, let's see, that's going to be evaluated between minus n and n, minus the integral of v du. And so that's the limit as n goes to infinity.
Remember when I was doing Fourier transform solving real problems, it was important that the things be zero at infinity, so this junk here would go away.
And that's exactly what we have in the Schwarz class here. Let's see, what have I got? My u is e to the minus 2 pi I xs, and my v is f of x. And remember, the Schwarz class,
this is bounded by 1 in modulus, so it doesn't do anything bad. But this thing goes to 0 at infinity really fast. And so this is going to be 0
in the limit. And it won't contribute. And let's see. This.
My du is negative, so I'm going to get minus and minus.
This is going to be plus an integral from minus n to n of 2 pi I s times f of x. Oops. My v du. My v is f of x. My du is 2 pi I s e to the minus 2 pi I xs dx. And now you see it. I can pull that 2 pi I s out in front. 2 pi I s. And then I have an integral from minus infinity to infinity of a regular Fourier transform. That is the Fourier transform of f. And so check.
There, I did a couple. They're all the same.
The very last one takes a little more writing, but I'll let you read it in Stein. It's not world-shaking thing extra to do. But now that I have all those things, I'm really close to being... On Friday, I'm going to show you the inversion formula, and it's going to pop right out. And it'll be fun. So all the hard work is done, I would say. Okay, that's enough for today. Tone it down. I'm going to give you some take-home thing that we're going to do. And then if your score is bigger than something, I'm going to